You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. 1 year ago today, as of this recording, on March 16th, 2020, there were 180,000 worldwide cases of COVID-19 with about 7,000 deaths and 80,000 recoveries. The nations most heavily hit were China, Italy, Iran, and Spain. There'd been a whole spectrum of political responses, everything from utter lockdown in East Asia to absolutely nothing in the UK. Boris Johnson never actually said herd immunity was what they were going for, but we all kind of knew it. In the U.S., we had between 3,500 and 4,000 cases in 49 states. Only West Virginia didn't have any yet, and that was probably just because they weren't testing. And we had 73 people dead. There was no accepted treatment and no cure. As of today, there have been 121 million cases in the world, with 2.6 million deaths. In the U.S., there have been about 30 million cases, so about a quarter of those, with 548,000 dead. There's still no cure, but we have numerous treatments, including six vaccines, at least two of which are phenomenally effective, and the other four are normally effective, all of which apparently ameliorate the symptoms and radically lessen the chances of hospitalization and death from COVID. Also, 1 year ago today, I talked to infectious disease expert Jessica Harden about COVID-19, and she is joining us again today to look back at the last year and to look forward at what's ahead. Jessica, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Coyle. I appreciate being here. It's crazy that it was only a year ago, and yet it seems like it was just yesterday and seems so far away at the same time.
Yeah, it was yesterday or it was 20 years. I don't know.
Exactly.
Which. And to prove that, a year ago, I had all of your credentials written down in front of me, and now I have none of them.
So my technical degree title is that I have a master's in emerging infectious diseases and biohazardous threat agents from the University of Georgetown. And I spent far too much time tracking infectious diseases and have spent far too much time reading about current outbreaks and historical outbreaks. I'm just a nerd. I like this stuff. So for better or for worse, I enjoy talking about infectious diseases, except when there's a pandemic. My joy in talking about them has greatly diminished, but it is a joy to be here speaking with you. So how would you like to kick it off?
Well, it's certainly okay if it's not a joy to talk to me. You can commiserate with my wife about that sometime.
I will.
I also understand. I have kind of a mild interest in infectious diseases and pandemic in part because of my agricultural background, dealing with cattle and mandatory vaccination laws and all of that, all of a sudden became super relevant, even though I thought, you know, it's been 20 years since I've been on the ranch. I'd never have to deal with that again. And yet, here we are. Let's maybe start with what we've learned. Other than the vaccines, because I do want to talk about those, can you give us sort of a brief summary of what's changed about what we know about COVID-19 since March of 2020?
That's such a great place to start because it highlights, I think we've learned so much and we've also realized how much we have left to learn. So just as a starting point, you know, with many really nasty, tricky outbreaks, COVID did several things that were quite contrary to conventional viral and epidemiological wisdom and expectations. And those wild cards really threw everybody for a loop. So the two were asymptomatic spread. Initially, it was really thought that wasn't a main driver. And then it quickly became evident that, no, actually asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic or mildly symptomatic transmission is actually having a big impact. And that really caught us flat-footed. And then the second, and this is really quirky and I still find fascinating, is the wild variety of symptoms, not just severity, but symptoms. Someone of the exact same demographic, you know, like let's not say 25-year-olds, but let's say two 65-year-olds, one of them might develop fever, cough, right, your classic COVID symptoms. Another might develop nausea and diarrhea and a fever and not develop the cough until they're hospitalized for dehydration 2 weeks later, right? Like, And then the third might just lose their sense of smell or have no symptoms at all. And that is extraordinarily rare. Like, I'm hard pressed to come up with a disease where you can have that amount of symptomatic variation in very similar patients. Like, you might have that. Yeah, but even, you know, usually even a cold, it might be more severe in one person, but you're still going to have similar-ish symptoms. And so that really messed us up. I think that really, so we learned, what were you going to say?
What, so Jessica, other than the losing your sense of smell, the rest of that, you know, Facebook tells me this is just the flu. Still, after a year, social media tells me this is just the flu. And to some extent, not that I agree with the crazy people on social media, but when my wife gets a flu shot and I get a flu shot, even though we're pretty close to the same age, we have different reactions to the same flu shot, right?
Right.
One of us is knocked out for a day and the other is fine and has no symptoms, or one of us is sore and the other is really sore, or one of us gets a fever and one of us doesn't.
Not because of the vaccine, but one of you later in the season gets the flu and one of you doesn't.
Right. Or we both actually get the flu,
yeah.
And one of us has a fever and one of us is, you know,
yeah,
nauseous. And again, so we do have diseases that have that spectrum. So how is COVID different?
So I think COVID is different in just the, usually, I mean, yes, with influenza, you might have slightly different, but most of the time you are going to present with the symptoms are a truck hit you and you have a fever, body aches, chills, sore throat, cough.
Right.
I mean, that's going to be your pretty classic flu presentation. And, you know, the differences might lay in you had that high fever for one day and she had it for five, right? This is different because, you know, to give an example, someone in my mother-in-law's neighborhood, she was sick with what she thought was a nasty GI bug. And she was sick for like a week. And then her daughter finally took her to the ER, where they did a test and come to find out she had COVID. She was admitted and developed a fever and a cough several days later. That's weird. I mean, and to be fair, other diseases do have different symptoms that appear, but this one I think kind of caught us a little off by exactly how different the symptom presentation can be. And it's not so much varying by demographic, like, oh, old people always get it like this and young people always get it like that. It can vary even within the demographic, especially once you get up above, I'd say, probably 30 to 45, as I think what the literature has said. Still, thankfully, the majority of, you know, cases that are going to end up being more severe do tend to be a little bit more classic. So they're a little easier to identify, your fever and cough. But I think it really threw clinicians for a loop because they're the ones on the front lines and they're looking at a disease that, yes, you know, if you're looking at that bell curve, the middle does still have those kind of classic COVID-ish kind of symptoms, but they can really have a lot of variation and even much more so than the flu. So it is a challenge. I think the other thing that we have learned since then is that it is just absolutely devastating for the elderly. So going back to kind of what we know now, we know that if you are, you know, if you have pre-existing conditions, so if you've got heart disease, COPD, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, cancer, pregnancy, or excess weight, or if you're a smoker, or if you have Down syndrome, you're looking at a much more serious disease than someone who doesn't have those factors. And if you are over 70, your chance of dying from COVID is just incredibly high in an infectious disease perspective. So it's much worse than it is with the flu. And if you're under 10, you know, it's so interesting is that kids under 10, now they're not magical anti-COVID unicorns, but they're also not these like hotbeds of disease, the under 10 age set. And that's really interesting because in a lot of other infectious diseases, even if kids are not seriously affected, even if they don't get really sick from it, they tend to spread disease. Like you're a parent of young children. They're quite efficient at spreading microbes. They're really good at it. But for whatever reason, we haven't seen that emerge. Now, is that because we haven't tested enough? I don't think so. At this point, I think, especially with schools reopening, I think there's both the epidemiological data, broadly speaking, and then also just the kind of like individual testing data that doesn't say that kids are still looking pretty good in this. So that's reassuring and helpful. on transmission. So, you know, the general body of research tells us that COVID is mostly transmitted via droplet and aerosol. And that's as opposed to the fomite transmission. Now I can't talk. Transmission, which is fomites are when you touch something and touch your face, which kids are really good at doing.
So I can stop washing my hands now, is what you're telling me.
No.
The era of that is over.
But you can stop washing your groceries. In fact, I pray that you stopped washing your groceries. If you ever started washing your groceries, please tell me you stopped like fumigating every piece of meal that came in your house.
Yeah, we never hit that point. By the time we had a spike here, we'd already passed that.
Yeah, we had our spike kind of early on. And so there was a period where I was eyeing the Clorox wipes like, I don't know, is that really worth it? And I was so thankful when the research came out saying that fomite transmission was not a big deal because it meant I would unload my Cheerios without any concern. So we should touch on droplet and aerosol real fast. So I think people think that there's this hard line between droplet transmission and aerosol transmission, and there's just not. So when you basically what it means is that SARS-CoV-2 infects the upper respiratory tract cells from which you liberally bless the air around you with a bunch of different size particles. So that might range from, you know, big drops of big drops of like virus laden spittle that kind of fall out of air really fast. And then itty bitty teeny little bits that kind of float and hang in the air for a variety of lengths of time. So that is, you know, that's kind of what we've learned, that initially it was thought, no, they can't get small enough that they can hang out in the air. We have enough evidence to say that, no, they can. But it's also on a spectrum. So it's not measles. You can walk in a room where someone with measles was 2 hours ago, and you can still pick up live infectious virus from the air. That disease is really infectious, and the virus can hang in the air for a long time. Evidence tells us that SARS-CoV-2 is not that, but it also tells us that it's a little bit more aerosol than we would have thought initially, and especially than we hoped initially. So what that tells us is that sharing indoor air is risky. And my general way of thinking about it is the longer you spend and the less air exchanges there are, the higher your risk is. You know, it's not like walking into a store and poof, all of a sudden you're at risk. And it's also not that you walk outside and you're free from risk. If you're having a conversation with someone and you're really animated and you're closer than 6 feet and you're 3 feet away from somebody, yeah, you can infect each other by standing outside and talking. But, you know, you step back a foot or two or three and you try not to like spit at them and you don't speak quite so forcefully, you reduce that risk. So I think that's been a really liberating thing to kind of recognize that there is there's a spectrum of risk there. And so once you understand that, I think you can make much more informed decisions about how you live your life. Being in indoor areas where you are doing aerosol generating activities for a prolonged period of time without good ventilation is a very bad idea if you're not vaccinated. And even if you are vaccinated, I'd still say it's a bad idea for right now. We'll get into that later. So we've also seen, just in terms of things that we've learned, Black and brown communities have been hit much harder than the white communities have. And, you know, it's really been heartbreaking to kind of see that trend unfold. Another thing that we've learned is that masks help. And that's
can I ask a question on the Black and brown communities? And I honestly haven't followed as closely with the numbers and communities. I assume some of that is urban versus rural, just concentrations of people, or am I?
Some, but some of it we think is also due to, you know, a higher proportion of jobs that require exposure to other people. So that could be some of it. But then also when you look among Black and brown communities, they also have higher rates, just pre-existing higher rates of heart disease and diabetes and other diseases that can kind of already predispose you to a more severe outcome. And then they tend to have lower access to healthcare. So perhaps they don't kind of recognize that they have those risk factors and take additional precautions. But then, you know, yeah, some of it may be urban, some of it may be the way that families tend to live, particularly families who are living in, as you said, urban areas where cost of living is just incredibly high. You might all be living in a smaller area. But then again, there does seem to be just a, yeah. And what is the term that I'm thinking of? oh goodness, as a public health person, I am ashamed. I do not, this is not rolling off the top of my tongue, but it's basically the idea that lots and lots of decades of really awful things that have happened to some of these populations have led to health outcomes that are more negative. And that, I think some of this might be related to that, and that that's what you tend to hear. So, okay, everyone listening, forgive me, forgive me. I'm rusty, clearly. But does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, like I said, that's good.
Okay. Other things, so I said before, so some, we know that masks help, and then some masks really, really help. Then there's a, again, there's a spectrum there. And I think people initially got really caught up on, well, if it's aerosol, then this silly scrap of cloth over my mouth doesn't make a difference.
I did have a surgeon tell me today that the mask I was wearing, a surgeon, not a surgeon who has been doing this for decades, tell me that the mask doesn't do anything because COVID, the virus itself, is so small that my mask is never going to stop it.
I would challenge that assertion partly on the fact that he needs, in order to really fully make that that assessment, he needs to know what the infectious dose is, which we still don't know. So that's how many viral particles you need in order to get infected. Second, he'd need to know the exact length of time that you were going to be depending on that mask to offer you any amount of protection. So a tiny scrap of cloth that is over your face and you're walking in and out of someplace, it might actually afford you a little protection. Would I depend on that if I were going to be any place for more than 15 minutes of time? No, no, I would not. You know, personally, I'm kind of an all or nothing sort of person. If I, yeah, I mean, if I'm outside, I'm going to tend to go for keeping 6 feet away from someone and using my facial expressions to communicate what I'm saying instead of shouting my head off. But if I'm going to be inside and sharing air with anybody, I've got an N95 on, or I've got a plastic silicone mask that forms to my face, and there's an opening in the front, and I can put a filter in, and it's a lot easier to talk and breathe, but it's an N95 filter. So so I agree with the surgeon, but I also think that the surgeon is getting into a kind of fatalism about it. But all listeners, please hear me. If you can, you should be using a better mask, especially if you're going to be in an indoor setting with anybody else for a prolonged period of time. So that is there's my PSA. Get a better mask. Right.
And just for the record, this surgeon is phenomenal at the kind of surgery he does, but he is totally into the plandemic stuff. So, sure. Yeah, you know.
That's just disappointing when it's a surgeon that has those thoughts.
You know, I live in rural Missouri, so... yeah, this is the virus that Barack Obama released from his secret Chinese lab, and he didn't say all of that. That's kind of bringing together several of my friends here.
And of course, you know, the reason that it's so bad is all because of China and because blah blah blah. I actually was listening to a Face the Nation interview, and I had to stop listening because the individual that was being interviewed kept trying to basically say, "Well, China was lying to us, and the WHO, you know, they were this political body and they just weren't telling us everything." And having worked on a project that tracked emerging infectious diseases and having done biosurveillance and worked with people in the intelligence community, that's just a really terrible excuse. If that is your explanation, then you need to not be doing the job that you're in, because you need to know that China is not going to always be forthright. And you need to also know that the WHO has so many considerations that feed into exactly how they release information and what it looks like, that you need to be able to see through that and interpret the signs on the ground. And believe me, there are ways of doing it that are cost effective and that we are fully capable of doing without needing to, you know, have China be perfectly honest about all of their cases. So, okay, but I digress.
I think we talked a little bit about that a year ago, but I don't remember.
We did too. I'm just so sad that it continues to be something that people go back to. Well, China. Well, if China had behaved better, it's like, no. Diseases are going to emerge. China's going to behave badly, or whatever country is going to behave, quote, badly. It's not always because they're trying to behave badly. It's just because they have their own interests and incentives. And, you know, I think what happened this time is that the provincial authorities in China were getting different pressures than they were getting than those who the more top line officials were. So I think in this case, the top line officials were actually trying to be a little more forthright, but the Wuhan officials actually had higher incentives to conceal. And you should just, you know, anyone who knows the countries and is interpreting what's happening for your country. You know, these are your lovely foreign policy people. They know that. There's a reason we have analysts who are very smart about these things and can kind of look at the country and suss out what's going on. It's because that kind of thing happens constantly. So it's our job as public health folks to kind of see through that and make good assessments based on what's actually happening and what we think is happening. So speaking of what we think is happening, we still have things that we don't really know. And I kind of want to touch on those. So if you're game, I'll run through some things that we don't fully know.
Tell us what we don't know.
Okay. Well, there's a lot. So I'll tell you I know that we don't know. Let me tell you the known unknowns that I'm thinking of. So there are plenty more. But the biggest one is, you know, what happens later? So several previous pandemics and other infectious diseases have been followed by a smaller but nonetheless notable wave of strange illnesses among those who were infected. So a really interesting example is after the 1918 influenza pandemic, and this is a little controversial because no one could kind of figure out exactly what happened or why it happened, but there was this thing called encephalitis lethargica, which was basically like people kind of got sick, they had neurological symptoms, and then they fell into this weird trance-like kind of state. And a lot of them didn't emerge and from it. They just kind of stayed in this vague here but not here phase. And it's quite odd. And so you saw, you know, in, I want to say 1917, they started seeing a few cases. By 19, I forget exactly the time period, but if you look, like there's a huge spike of influenza. And then within a couple of years, encephalitis lethargica just surges and there's a pandemic of it. It happens all over the world. There are these weird cases. And then just as quickly as it came, it goes. And we're not exactly sure, was it tied to the pandemic? Was it completely independent? I think the current theory or the recent theory was that it had something to do with just the inflammatory reaction that some people had to the influenza virus then resulted in them having this outcome later. Another well-documented example is that for one in 25,000 kids with measles, one of them will develop an invariably fatal form of encephalitis several years later. And that number is actually one in 5,500 for children under age one. So that's, and this is years later, like your kid seems fine, they've recovered, phew, dodged a bullet, and then they develop this, I think it's called sclerosing panencephalitis, but it's a invariably fatal and your kid just goes downhill. It's heartbreaking. So I think, especially with a disease that causes quirky symptoms, neurological symptoms, like a loss of sense of smell, the question I have is, you know, will we have sequela later? Like, will people who are infected, you know, will a whole generation whose moms got infected while they were pregnant, what will we see? You know, there's actually like a slight height difference between children who were born to moms who were infected with the 1918 strain. They were a very slight amount shorter than every other age cohort who was born around them, which is just fascinating to think like that it had that impact. So that's one of the questions. But then, you know, some of the other things that we don't know are like, why do some people become severely ill and others coast through? Like, why are children not major drivers of the infection? And then, you know, why do some people's, ooh, this is one I really want to know. Why do some people end up infecting tons of people? And then other people, none at all. So for example, I've got a good friend. Her husband became sick. They have four children. They all quarantined at home. He was quite sick. They shared a bed and they have a small house and four children. And I remember she was talking to me one day on the phone and she's like, oh, then now my kid is drinking after my COVID infected husband. Excellent. And nobody else in the family tested positive for it. So what happened there? I think that's one of those curiosities that will just have to be sussed out in time and with research. And I really hope that we can kind of dig into some of those questions. So,
right. I assume some of that is behavior, right? I mean, some of that is the person who just decides they are not going to quarantine.
Absolutely. And sings in a church service with symptoms. Like, yes, absolutely. That person is going to end up infecting more people. But I'm also curious about the people like my friend's husband who, you know, he was in a close household setting with other people. epidemiological data suggests that that would be a high transmission setting. Was there something about the particular strain that he was infected of that wasn't, you know, wasn't as bad at spreading? Or was there something protective in his family, or had they had it before? Like, I don't know. Did they end up with asymptomatic infection that just got missed by PCR testing? Those are all live options. I think it's just a question. But you're absolutely correct that a lot of it, when you think about it, quote, quote, super spreader, has a lot to do with the conditions. So a closed, an enclosed space with poor ventilation and lots of virus being loaded in the air and lots of vulnerable noses breathing it in. That is a key way that we are going to see tons of cases pop out of something.
Well, let's talk briefly, unless you have anything more to say
on
what we've covered. Let's briefly talk about the vaccine. So my understanding is there are currently six in circulation. So the Pfizer and Moderna ones, and I remember reading this, and maybe this was a mistake in the article I was reading, but the Moderna vaccine was ready January 25th last year. And which, you know, cue your conspiracy theorists, right? But they really did just hit the ground running in Wuhan. I mean, they had this technology already ready. But it took them that long. They still didn't beat Pfizer because it took them that long to do all the testing and get the approvals and what have you. AstraZeneca, of course, the British, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, Johnson & Johnson has one. The Russian vaccine, I believe, is called Sputnik, which is a great name for a vaccine. And I have no idea what the Chinese one is called. But both the Russians and the Chinese also had vaccines very early, I think last June or July.
Which is amazing, considering how long it usually takes us to bring a vaccine to market. So I think that just speaks really well of, A, what happens when you muster the kind of laboratory insights of the entire world to try and figure this out. I think it also speaks well of the research that's been going on for decades into making better vaccines, which I think is why Moderna was able to hit the ground running so fast, and is ultimately why we have three vaccines today that are going into arms in the U.S. So I am most familiar with Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. It's actually Janssen, Johnson & Johnson, which is a huge mouthful. So I just call it the Trip-J vaccine because it's easier to say. So, and then the Oxford AstraZeneca, I know a little bit about as well. So
yeah, I know nothing about, I guess I know the Russian one has been picked up by several Eastern European EU countries.
Interesting.
Because of the train wreck they've run into. The EU, this is maybe a side note, the EU did a block negotiation with Pfizer and AstraZeneca and Moderna. And the goal of that was to get the price lower because, of course, they wanted to pay less for it. But Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca all had a first come, first serve. So the U.S. was like, yeah, we'll pay whatever.
Yeah.
Put us on your list first. And the EU wasn't. So supply was a challenge. So several Eastern European countries, I think, I'm going to get this wrong, I think including places like Hungary and Slovakia, just said, you know what, we're going with the Russian one. We'll just get a bunch of Russian vaccines and ship them in. So
I don't blame them. That sounds like a disaster that I don't feel like I would want my government to be budget shopping for vaccines in a pandemic. I feel like you're going to lose out on that one.
Well, and again, I get the appeal, like the EU at the beginning of the negotiation was very like, we're going to stand together. Like we're going to show, we're all going to start vaccinating the same day.
Right.
Like all across Europe, we're going to start with, and we're all going to follow the same model. That one, I think it was the Czech Republic was like, you know, we're ready to go now. We're going to go ahead and start.
Yeah.
And again, I see the appeal of both sides of that. Why don't you talk to us about the ones you do? And again, sinfully, maybe I just assume the Chinese vaccine is they just decided they didn't care and we're going to experiment and did what it took. But maybe that's me being ungenerous to the Chinese government.
I confess I do not know a lot about the Chinese one.
I don't either.
More of my mental resources on the ones that I would actually put in my arm. And I just don't know anything about the Chinese one. I know that I'm not going to have the opportunity to have that in my arm. So I have not looked into it as much, perhaps, as I should.
I mean, at this point, I would probably take, like, well, I've had the Moderna one, but I would have taken the Chinese vaccine maybe as early as December, because you're not going to vaccinate a billion people with a faulty vaccine.
No. Oh, I agree completely. And to be clear, like I would actually be more than happy to have a Chinese vaccine so long as the efficacy and safety data is there. And I think you're probably correct that once you have a billion people, you know, vaccinated, and to be fair, they don't have a billion that they've already vaccinated. But
sure.
The beauty of having a pandemic, you know, when people would use, and I even said this, like I would prefer not to be the first person in line, even though I did consider signing up for vaccine trials, which I do think is funny that on the one hand, I'm like, no, I don't think I want to be the first person to get it. But then I'm like, no, actually, I'd be happy to help the science figure out how it would work.
Right.
There's probably a little curiosity there. But I think part of the beauty of vaccinating in a pandemic is that, you know, my husband got his first shot today, and you've already seen millions. The Moderna has already gone into millions of arms. And so usually when you are taking a medication from your doctor, I tend to favor older drugs just because I think that you get the best data after it's been in a million people for a good little bit of time. So for all those who are listening and might be skeptical, check. Like it's been in millions of people and it's been in them for a long time. And no one has developed laser vision, sadly. No one has become Spider-Man, sadly.
We do all love Bill Gates a lot more.
Yeah.
Like a lot more than we did.
That's right. Yes. And it's funny how it seems that they know where we're going. Oh, wait, that's our cell phones.
Right. I've only had the one shot, so I just kind of like him.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, maybe he should be in charge of everything.
Yeah,
so
you feel content having him be in charge of everything now.
Yeah. Yeah. He's only 80 or however old he is.
Yes. Yes. I do think that what's fascinating to me is that looking at all of the pushback that there has been against vaccines and against treatments and even against the virus itself, these patterns are so extraordinarily familiar. They happen in every single pandemic, and honestly, almost in every single epidemic. If you look at a major epidemic, you are going to see these exact, like nothing is new. Nothing under the sun is new. It's just updated for microchips or updated for whatever the current kind of frenzy of whatever the most exciting, interesting, and scary thing that is out there, that tends to be what is fixated upon. So, okay.
Yeah, I think there is the difference though is you're the expert on this. Maybe I shouldn't disagree. I'm not disagreeing. I think the strength of the response to this one, is in part because of the randomness of the. Symptoms and the relative lightness of the symptoms for most of the people who get it, if that makes sense. So if this were Ebola, and you know, you started bleeding from your eyes or whatever, I think there would be that initial spike of skepticism, and then all of a sudden,
great,
like yeah, we'll take the vaccine.
Yes, I think you were absolutely correct. And you actually hit on something. So within public health, there are diseases that hit pretty populations and diseases that hit ugly populations, right? And not, let's take pretty and ugly out of it, but there are those diseases that hit our heartstrings, right? If polio paralyzed little kids, right? Heart, yep. Terrifying, awful, will do anything to prevent my child from getting that, right? COVID? I might have the sniffles. I might lose my sense of smell. Oh, does that mean I lose a couple pounds? Like, I think people's perspective and fearfulness of it, you know, it does not strike fear in the hearts the same way that a disease that kills or maims individuals who we perceive to be in their prime of health. I think that also, as Christians, I think it should trouble our hearts because COVID is extraordinarily deadly for those who are over 70. And I what does it say about how our culture has informed our perspectives of humanity and humans' worthiness of living that we are much more concerned with a disease that affects the young than we are with a disease that affects people that we don't see, people who are in nursing homes, things like that? And, you know, are we making value judgments about human life? So that's probably more in your area of, of ethical thought and things like that. But that's something that's rattled around in my brain.
I mean, in mild defense of the culture, it's mostly the people over 70 who are saying they just don't care.
We tried for the longest time. We're like, you know, but you might get infected by our children. We don't want to kill you. And she's like, I don't care anymore. I'm 78. I want to see my grandchildren. So I think it is very true. And I should get off my high horse and not be, I think it's so easy. Excuse me. It's so easy to, not COVID, so easy to chastise. it's so easy to kind of create straw men without meaning to. And it's something that even, no matter how hard you fight against it, I think you find yourself doing. So, okay, back to vaccines. So,
yeah, sorry, I interrupted. Vaccines.
No, this is all really good. I could clearly talk about this all day. So vaccines, the vaccines we are most familiar with are killed or attenuated viral vaccines. So this means that you take an infection and then you're going to weaken it. And you are going to, you're going to weaken it and then give it to a person that will trigger an immune response without getting them sick. Or if you kill it, you know, it'll go in and the body will be like, huh, what is this? It'll process it. It'll come up with antibodies. It'll develop immunity to it. The beauty of, and one other thing about those vaccines, they have other substances in them that help draw the immune system's attention to the invader. So it's almost like a hype man for the vaccine. And then they also have preservatives in them. And sometimes the preservatives also work like the hype man that kind of draw in. But those are going to be your thimerosal or other things. They're called adjuvants. And those tend to be where a lot of the pushback has been on the vaccines. So beautiful thing about an mRNA vaccine. Those boogers are stripped down. All an mRNA vaccine is this tiny little piece of mRNA that encodes for the spike protein. And then they stick it inside of this nanolipid particle. So basically it's got fat sunscreen around it, right? And that's why they have to be kept extraordinarily cold, because the moment they warm up, that nanolipid capsule becomes unstable and it breaks apart and the mRNA falls apart. So that's why you have to keep it at negative 70 degrees Celsius, which is just absurd, but that's what you have to do. So basically it's almost like giving your body just the recipe. You're not even giving the ingredients. You're even doing some of the pre-work for them. And it just goes straight into your cytoplasm, and then the mRNA is transcribed directly into the spike protein. And then there's also, so the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson, or the TripJ, those are both adenovirus. So the AstraZeneca is a chimp adenovirus, and then the Johnson & Johnson is just a regular adenovirus. And what they do is they basically take the capsid, or just the outer shell of a virus, they take everything out from inside of it, and then they stick up inside of it just the same kind of spike protein piece of DNA. And so what that is going to do is the virus then goes in, it latches onto your cell, and it shoots in, instead of shooting in a bug that would make you, instead of shooting in material that would make a new vaccine, not a new vaccine, material that would make a new virus that would then replicate and get you sick, it shoots in a piece of DNA that tells your cell to make the spike protein. Spike protein is put up on the side, and your body gets the same kind of quick lesson in how to look for this. So that's kind of the quick and dirty on the science of it. Let's talk about the controversy. The controversy over AstraZeneca that they've recently run into is that in Europe, there was a handful, and when I say handful, I mean a handful, 30 or so cases of individuals who developed deep vein thrombosis, right? So it might have been a pulmonary embolism or a clot that traveled to the brain, something like that. This is not good, obviously. You see that and you think, oh dear, is something wrong? But here's the thing. The 30 or so cases that they detected of that, that's actually far fewer than you would even expect to find among the general population, just given how many people that they vaccinated. So I think what you're looking at is correlation, not causation. And that's what a lot of experts who have been looking at this have been saying. Now, is it wise for them to stop vaccination until they kind of dig into this a little further? And to be clear, 17 million people have been vaccinated and they've detected 30 or so of these events. And the average incidence among the general population is pretty high. And so finding 30 is actually not that alarming in terms of, but the concern I have, Coyle, the thing I'm worried about is that, do you know what else can cause major clotting issues? COVID,
yeah.
And so when you stop vaccinating with a vaccine because you're concerned about clotting issues, I get it. And I think we need to do due diligence and make sure that there's nothing else going on. But with that being said, it is a problem if you end up with more individuals infected who then actually end up having very legitimate issues with clotting because of COVID infection. So,
okay, so just to wrap up vaccines, if you could, you know, lay the six that we've got out in front of you and say, all right, which one do you want? Which vaccine would you take?
I'd honestly be cool with any of them because all of them are 100% effective at preventing hospitalization and death. And let's be honest, I don't take a shot in the arm to prevent the sniffles. I'm okay with being sick. I'm not okay with dying, with causing someone else to die, or with being hospitalized in overwhelming hospitals. So I would honestly go for any of them. And I would be delighted to have an mRNA vaccine just because I think it's really cool from a technological standpoint, and I'm all for doing that. So I would go for any of them. The Johnson & Johnson is appealing because I bet I could get it on my own schedule even, because it's available. It doesn't have to have the same cold chain storage. So if they're all laid out in front of me, I would just say whichever one can get in my arm most easily. Maybe I should take one of the harder ones because I have the flexibility in my schedule to go back twice. And maybe I should leave the trip J for someone who doesn't have that flexibility. So I really would be cool with any of them. Do you have any preferences? You already have the Moderna.
Yeah, we're a Moderna county, I guess. It's not my preference. It's just what we have.
Yeah.
My understanding is they have a higher efficacy overall, the mRNA ones. But is that right, or are they all about equal?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because the mRNA vaccines were actually tested before we had tons of variants surging around. So I worry that the TripJ, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I worry that it's gotten a bad rap because people hear 66% efficacy and they think, well, that's not going to work as well. But what they need to be thinking is that was overall efficacy, and it was tested in South Africa. South Africa has the B1351 variant. I think I got that right. We really need some better names for these variants, but unfortunately, they'll just probably remain the South Africa variant, which they should get credit for detecting because we were so far behind in detecting our own variants, but it's really sad. However, the South Africa variant tends to evade the immune system a little bit more than some of the others. The Brazil variant is particularly concerning. They've actually had reinfection in areas where they've already had huge outbreaks, and they've had hospitals overwhelmed again. So the fact that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine offers 60% efficacy, which we should probably define what that means, because that doesn't mean that, you know, I want to say the Moderna's had 90% efficacy. That doesn't mean that 90 times out of 100 that you're exposed to the virus, you're not going to get it. It means that compared to the placebo group, you have a tenfold reduction in your presence of disease afterwards. So that's kind of a like mental messy thing to get our heads around, because I think we get stuck on 60 and we think that's failing. But no, that's actually amazing. And if you consider our flu vaccines, their efficacy can vary wildly season to season. And they can even be in the, you know, 40% range. 40% efficacy, they can. And we will still say that that's actually not too bad because we're thinking about it from the population wide perspective. And if you vaccinate all of your population with a vaccine that only has 40% efficacy, you're still going to see a reduction in hospitalizations and death. That's measurable and makes a big difference. Does that mean that you or I might still get the flu? Yeah, we might still get the flu, but it means that on the whole, the country's going to do better. So when we hear about efficacy with these vaccines, particularly vaccines that were tested after the variant came out, you need to take that with a grain of salt, because I bet your Moderna and your Pfizer's, if they were tested in an area where the Brazil variant, that's the P1, or where the South Africa, the B1351, whatever it is, I think you would also see a dip in efficacy. But there is still some efficacy there, and that's good. That is really good, because we don't have to stop it entirely to get our country back to a place where we can live somewhat normal-ish lives. Like, we just need it to not be killing us constantly, and to the point that it is crushing our hospitals and overwhelming our healthcare system and making things really challenging. And so that is the goal, is not zero COVID. The goal is getting us to a point where we can lead lives and make reasonable choices. And when you couple the vaccine with wearing masks, washing hands, trying to avoid lots of shared air, yeah, you can really reduce your risk of infection.
Well, that sort of answers the next question I had. What's left to be done, right? We've got a vaccine. Isn't that, can't we say mission accomplished and go about our lives?
Yes, I wish that. Wouldn't that be nice? That would be really nice. We have a vaccine. Poof, let's just be.
We have four vaccines.
Yeah.
Three in America, one in England.
Yes.
Let's call it.
Let's call it. We're done.
Right? Miller time.
Okay, so I think one thing we really need to keep in mind is that for a little bit longer, we need to remain very cautious, and that is because we need to protect the vaccine. So I know I just said it's great that the P1, that the Brazil variant and the South Africa variant are still somewhat vulnerable to the TRIPJ and the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines. Coyle, do you want to think of a wonderful way that we could really mess this up? By exposing a bunch of people who have been vaccinated to a bunch of different variants of the vaccine, because we are playing viral roulette every time that you expose a vaccinated person to a new form of vaccine, to virus. And the more virus that you have going around in the community, the more variants you're going to have. I mean, it just, viruses mutate. That's what they do. What we don't want to do over the next, I'd say, 8 to 12 weeks, what we don't want to do is have raging transmission and have vaccinated people mingling really freely with unvaccinated people as though they are impenetrable, right? You are not totally impenetrable after you have the vaccine. We want it to keep working, but we need to get transmission down, because there's always that risk, however small, that if there is a variant out there that can actually evade the immune system and evade the vaccine variant, that virus has, that variant has a really significant evolutionary leg up, right? It will be able to access so many immune naive people that the other variants can't do. And so that's why you see, like, any variant that's going to have an advantage, like it's more transmissible, or it can infect people who have already had it, those are the ones that you're going to see propagating more and more and more. So that's why you're hearing everybody say, okay, wait, before you get all excited, just hold off just a little bit longer. Keep your mask on. Don't go hog wild. Don't go in church, rip that mask off and sing at the top of your lungs next to your fellow saints, even though you really want to. This is not quite the time. Wait until viral transmission gets down low enough that we just are, it's a much lower risk. Does that make sense? That, I think, is the first thing we need to do.
So Jessica, we shouldn't imagine this is the last pandemic that we'll ever experience, but we also don't necessarily want to reorient our lives around something that happens every 80 years or so. But we should still, you know, think about what to do next. You know, how do we tackle being more prepared for the next pandemic to come along?
Gosh, I love that question. You know, I'm so torn between, like, challenging your premise that we shouldn't reorient our lives and encouraging you just to kind of think differently, that, like, I think we can and should adopt changes that significantly reduce risk without reorienting our lives. But I also think that, you know, I kind of do think it's worth reorienting a little bit, because if you look back at most of our major public health interventions, they were almost all viewed as unnecessary and onerous at the time. Like, there was huge pushback against hand washing, but now it's just a commonplace activity. Like, it's so baked into your day that if I were to say, how many times did you wash your hands today? I bet you probably couldn't even count. So you just kind of would guess. Well, it was, you know, after I went to the bathroom and before I ate and when I came home. And it's just a normal part of your day-to-day existence. You just don't even notice it. So I think our job now is to examine our lives and think about how we live, and then think about our riskiest behaviors and decide how we could kind of bake in effective disease prevention into our culture and our best in built environments, so that it prevents the next outbreak that happens. Like, I'm a firm believer that the best public health measures are those that you don't even think about. You know, they just exist in our culture unquestioned, and they're perfectly normal. Like I said, like, we wash our hands after we use the bathroom and usually before we eat. Like we don't let poop mix in our drinking water, and we don't drink after people or spit on food. You know, okay, I eat after my children, which I never would have said I would do before, but they're my children. But I don't eat after random strangers. There are things that are now kind of culturally taboo. So I think personally, I think it's time to rethink our built spaces. And here's where it will sound like I'm asking us to reorient our lives, but bear with me and hear me out. So I think for decades, we've kind of had the glorious luxury of diseases being like nuisances that we can power through and not genuine threats that we should be respecting and avoiding. But in the past 20 years, we've radically changed how we live our lives, right? Like we hop on planes and fly all over the world, and you have kids that go spelunking in caves in far-flung places and then hop on a jet and show up in a crowded bar in Las Vegas, and they could pick anything up and bring it back. And so we play viral roulette every single day. And instead of our built environment being a buffering zone that kind of absorbs the concussion of that inevitable viral gunshot, it really served to amplify it. Like our buildings are engineered to maximize energy efficiency, but not to maximize air ventilation, right? Security wins over sanitation when grocery stores have everybody flow through a few checkout lines, or airlines start everybody off at a security checkpoint before dispersing people into terminals. You know, beauty beats out over sanitation when our sinks are hidden in bathrooms in the back of a store that is really nasty and you feel like you've basically gotten dirtier by going in and seeing it than by washing your hands. Like you don't feel like you benefited. You know, schools cram kids into box-like rooms for really long hours, often with minimal air exchanges, and the windows are often welded shut for safety. This was a huge issue when I started working with local schools, especially private ones. So many of their windows had been welded shut for safety so that they could meet different codes, or so that, you know, or the windows just don't even open anymore. So, you know, even hospitals and doctor's offices crowd patients through narrow multi-purpose corridors, and there's tons of shared diagnostic areas. Addressing even a little bit of this, I think, would make us a lot more prepared to handle future threats. And I don't think that this has to be extreme. And I don't think that I think, again, we want to avoid the surgeon's impulse of, oh, that mask is worth nothing, you should just throw it away. I think we should start by saying, okay, when you have a lot of people in a room, crack a window. Just increase the number of air exchanges that you have per hour. I would love it if really crowded places like schools, places where there are lots of people, if they would invest in CO2 monitors, because CO2 monitors are actually a pretty good proxy for how much virus you're seeing build up in an area. Because each time that we talk and breathe, we're going to expel a little bit more CO2 in. And if you have good ventilation and if there's good air exchanges, you'll see that drop. And so what I think we should do is start to look at some of these spaces where people are in, are congregating, and where you see high transmission able to happen, and just ask ourselves, what are some simple things? Air is simple. Like it's complicated in that we try to seal up our buildings so that they stay warm and warm in the winter and cool in the summer. But air is fairly easy to bring in and out. And I don't think that we have to do all of these things at high cost. I think that this is the beauty of markets. Like we kind of say, hey, this is what we want. And poof, there will be really good solutions. So that's my first kind of what we think. Do you have any challenge to that? And I realize I kind of like cherry picked your
purpose. No, that's fine. I'm a school. There never needs to be a school with more than 300 kids in it. So anything to break the factory schooling system.
Yes.
Also anything to eliminate TSA.
Hey.
Yes, you should not have to go through all of that to get on an airplane. So. Yep, that's just a confirmation bias. So I'm happy to embrace all of that.
So the other thing I kind of want to dive into is that, unfortunately, outbreaks occur with concerning regularity. And I think that they're going to continue occurring. And I think that we're going to see it step up. And I wish that wasn't the case, but I'm pretty confident that will be the case. So, you know, in 2009, we had H1N1 that roared around the world. Thankfully, it wasn't that bad. In 2016, Zika tried and thankfully failed to kind of lodge itself up in the Northern Hemisphere. But that's largely because we didn't have the Aedes aegypti mosquito extending up as far as the virus probably wanted to travel. But, you know, in the past 50 years, we kind of radically changed the way we live our lives, and we've really increased our chances of getting another pandemic. But even beyond just novel diseases that can race through immune-naive populations, we've got simmering threats that could really force us to change the way we live if we're not careful about it. So Ebola just broke back out in West Africa, and the genetic lineage suggests that it came from, wait for it, a survivor of the 2014 outbreak. That is years after the initial outbreak, and that's a game changer. Like, filoviruses aren't generally thought of doing that. That this then suggests that a human could actually serve as the next vector for the start of another outbreak. And think about what that means if you are if you're a doctor in Africa and you see a patient coming in with fever and diarrhea. Suddenly, Ebola actually has to be a normal part of your differential diagnosis, even though this patient could be from a, you know, an urban part of Sierra Leone. But suddenly you're curious about, well, you know, who have they had contact with? And then the Ebola outbreak was so large, the same way that we saw asymptomatic infection, and we saw it a lot, unfortunately, with COVID, you know, they're realizing that it seems like some Ebola survivors actually might have had a milder illness and not realized that they had it. And so there's concern that you could actually have individuals reinfecting individuals and not even know that that's happening. So, A, if you're a doctor on the ground in Africa, that's a really alarming thing, and we need to get better data around it. So there's going to be lots of research into whether or not that actually is what happened. And we can all pray that that's not the case, because that is a very scary scenario for people on the ground. Internationally, it is also concerning. So fast forward a couple of years, you know, you have a population that was all exposed to the virus. There was a shocking amount of death, and there are a decent number of survivors. And so those survivors are still going to live lives, and they should, and they shouldn't be discriminated or stigmatized. But what could happen is that the same way that the doctor in Africa who sees someone with fever and diarrhea, you could be a doctor in Munich, right? And you have a patient coming in who has been in the area of West Africa, sorry, West Africa, and presents with this kind of disease that previously you would have thought was maybe typhoid or perhaps malaria or maybe, and suddenly like Ebola does kind of have to be on the differential. And so that's a big problem in terms of how we think about how we deliver healthcare to people and how we kind of live our lives together. So things that I think could help, now that I've kind of scared you, I think, again, making our built environments more forgiving, that is key. But also, I think surveillance has to be a part of this. I think we should invest in a long-term, broad-based, open-source disease surveillance system that augments traditional public health surveillance systems. Okay, so I should define some of these terms.
Yeah. Let's clarify that, because you don't mean Bill Gates' cameras on every corner keeping track of our faces.
No, and I do not. So right. Let me tell you what traditional public health looks like. It looks like a needle in the arm of someone who is actively sick, and then taking that back to usually a WHO reference lab, and the reference lab confirms what it is or is not, or maybe they don't know. Maybe it then gets sent on to a bigger laboratory. Maybe something happens, the sample gets lost, they have to go back, they have to test more people who are then sick. Thankfully, since the 2014 Ebola outbreaks, Africa is actually a lot better in terms of where they have really solid laboratory capabilities. So that's improved a lot. I'd say in the last 10, 15 years, you've seen big improvements there. However, it's not uniform, and it still is very true that it takes time to get boots on the ground, to go to where the sick people are, to capture samples, take them back to a laboratory, process, figure out what's going on, and see what it could possibly be. So that's incredibly time consuming, but it is accurate. Usually. So that's in more traditional public health, right? So you're going to get laboratory results that say, yes, that person has COVID. Yes, that person has Ebola. Yes, this person has Lassa fever, whatever it would be, or influenza, a new type of influenza. Okay, so that's one way of doing it. It is accurate, but slow. That's traditional public health. When you talk about disease surveillance systems, these are different from the forecasting models. So I think we're all familiar with the forecasting models that say, okay, by this date, you're going to have this many cases in this area. That's not what I'm talking about. I am talking about open source, which is to say anything that you and I can legally access online. It means it's not classified. It means you don't have boots on the ground. It means you are not Bill Gates spying on people. It just means, what can you tell by the trends that are happening all around the world? So this is what I did at Georgetown for years, and it actually was quite effective and really fascinating the way that it worked. So what happens is, when an outbreak occurs in an area like, let's say China, China's a great example, basically that outbreak causes what we would call social disruption. And that social disruption results in a change, right, that you can kind of see from the outside if you know what you're looking for, even in uber oppressive regimes, even in places where the internet is locked down, you will still get murmurings. And these murmurings are different than conspiracy theories. They behave differently in the kind of world of data. Like, they look different from the other signals that you get. So what you can do is you can actually begin to develop algorithms of indicators and warnings that will tell you, okay, I don't know for sure that this is what is happening, but this sequence of events has tended to precede Rift Valley fever outbreaks. And right now in this area, we are now seeing, you know, a cascade of events that looks a whole lot like that. So we can say, without having boots on the ground, I think there's a Rift Valley fever outbreak over here, or there's a likelihood that that is what it is. Now, you might be saying, yes, but what do you do with that? Because it's not perfectly accurate data. It's not, but you pair it with that traditional public health data, and you use it to get better information quicker. And how does that apply in a big outbreak like a COVID-19 outbreak? Oh my goodness, Coyle, do you know how many times I was like wishing that we could have had that type of surveillance system set up during the COVID-19 pandemic? It was so often, because what it can do is it can basically say, okay, all right, America, let's look at you. Okay, New York City, something crazy is happening. You need to lock down. Baton Rouge, holy moly, Mardi Gras, something has happened. You guys need to chill out. Like, nobody needs to go anywhere. Shut down all your bars, shut down your restaurants, shut down your churches. Nobody go to school. Like, shelter in place. But Miami, you're actually okay. North Carolina, like, nothing seems to be popping yet. Okay, proceed with caution, right? Like, maybe let's stick to, but that is the difference. It's not that we can say with certainty that, yes, New York City has an outbreak of XYZ. But what we can say is that there are unusual patterns that are emerging in these different areas. And if you have an ongoing known outbreak, what you can begin to do is merge together lots of different data streams. And the cool thing is, we did this back when basically, like, Twitter was in its infancy and Facebook was a big deal. And so now, to think about the fact that we have so many more data streams. And what do I mean by data streams? I mean voluntary information that's being provided by thermometers. So people will actually take temperatures and then log the temperature. And they agree through having a, they agree to share some of that data anonymously. So you don't know that, like, Coyle has a fever, but you do know that, like, within this geographic area, there's been a spike. And then you can also pair that with, like, purchasing orders, right? So you can tell, like, what on earth is happening that all the cough syrup in this area is out, right? So the real beauty of this is that you can connect that actually with your frontline healthcare providers. And if you can connect your frontline healthcare providers with this type of, you know, not perfect, rather ambiguous, but if they know how to use it, incredibly valuable data, where they can be looking at a patient who has a fever and diarrhea and say, okay, you just returned from travel from an area that also happens to have XYZ or historically had blah, blah, blah. Okay, maybe I need to consider that. Maybe I don't. Or, you know, I have, this is my third fever and cough case in a day, and it's in the middle of May. That's kind of odd. And you look up and you realize that, like, oh, in my city, there's actually an enormous number of fever and cough cases. Traditionally, that information takes days to go from hospital and doctor's office all the way to regional public health office, up to state public health office, generally to CDC, and then back again. And that takes time. And so what this can basically do is take that time out of it. The reason I think there's been resistance is because I feel like it's hard, I think, for those who are in the traditional public health setting to kind of know exactly how to interpret that data that has static in it, right? Because it is noisy data. How do you do that? My feeling is that all data has noise. So even when you think back to the early data coming out of the pandemic, when we were doing testing quite poorly, we were saying, oh, well, there's no cases over here. But that's because we were saying only test people with these very specific symptom and criteria. So we just weren't testing. We weren't testing enough people. And so that, you know, that very quickly corrupted our data, right? And so I think all data is prone to noisiness or to messiness. And so for me, I think when you're thinking about how do we prevent being caught flat-footed in a situation like this, I think we do it by having a system that's agile and yes, messy, but paired with, you know, really thoughtful public health individuals who can interpret the data properly. And then also like clinicians who are able to look at it and recognize real time what it might mean for them and for the patients that are sitting in front of them. I think that is how you end up with tailored strategic public health responses as opposed to everybody stay in your houses and nobody breathe. I think that's kind of how you break out of that. So any thoughts on that? I know I've been rambling.
No, this is so far outside of my field. It sounds like something that, you know, any given local community could just decide to work on if it wanted to.
I wish that were the case. It's yes and no. So I think you need a system that is, you need something. You could take one of the existing systems and begin to beef it up. But I do think that this is where having a program that is broader, because like if Louisville put together their own little system, yes, they could do it for their local area, but the real power comes when you not just have it in, you know, Kentucky, but you also have it tied into all these other places, which is where I think it is beautiful if you have a system that is looking at everything. And that's where the real kind of power comes in, when you have a broader perspective that has been tied in also locally. And there are small efforts that work, but I think you need them to kind of all be tied together. Does that make sense?
Sure. And that's maybe a conversation for another day. Can or should our government do something like that? I'm kind of on the side that, yeah, it has the constitutional power to do so.
Yeah.
Competence, you know, different question.
And having lived through the government contracting process, I would say contracts can be amazing ways to kill really good ideas. And so I don't know what the answer is there. I do think that constitutionally, actually, I tend to be one who prefers solutions to problems that are coming from, I would rather my local authorities be doing something, because I think that, you know, they are more likely to know what is going to work best in their community. I tend to be one who doesn't like large federalized solutions, but I do think there are a handful of things that the federal government is better equipped to fund and figure out. And this is one of them. And I think that you can do it in a way that is not plagued by the usual ham-handedness of large federal things. And honestly, it would be cheaper than a cost of one fighter jet. And so it's very hard as a public health person to look at this and think like how much we spend on traditional security and think this tiny little microbe filled us all and destroyed our economy and killed over 500,000 people. And I think having a system like this, that's not sexy. It's not a big fancy plane that flies overhead. It's kind of boring when there's not a huge outbreak going on. It really is. And I would suggest tying it to universities so that you can have ongoing data. And I would also suggest to stay in the forefront, because we had to deal with privacy and security concerns as well. I actually think that you should partner with people who study those things. because there will be new issues that arise constantly. And the way that you address them is not by saying, oh, well, we shouldn't do any of it, but by like being very forward thinking and asking those questions and then publicizing your data as you figure out what you think the solutions should be. Because like on the projects that I worked on, you cannot track US citizens, right? You don't want to track an individual person. How do you collect this data and interpret it while also preserving individuals' rights of protection and privacy? And that is actually where, if we want good policy to come out of it, we need to study it. We need to think well about it. So I think that there are ways we can do it. Do I think it'll be hard? Sure. But I think we need to do it. So, okay, that's my two cents.
Jessica, give us a final thought. What should we take away here?
Yeah, this is more of a warning than a final thought, but you know, the next pandemic will not look like the last one. So we need our public health and our intelligence to be more agile, more willing to think outside the box, and really, as hard as it is to say, like less stuck on the past as precedent. So outbreak after outbreak, we've gotten caught flat-footed because we've relied quite heavily on the experiences of the past. You know, whether it was the idea that Ebola would burn itself out or the thought that the symptom presentation would be more consistent or the asymptomatic spread wasn't a major driver for outbreaks like this, I think we need to take steps to ensure that we let the past inform us, but without constraining us. And this is where I really do like letting, there's been a lot of talk of, are you familiar with the phrase epistemological trespassing? You know, where you have economists come in and do epidemiologist right. work and it can get messy. I think this is actually a place where that actually would be useful, because I think there are plenty of industries where people, particularly entrepreneurs are amazing at looking at where the market has been and thinking about where they want to take a risk and let it go. And I wonder if we need to inject a little bit more of that. We've done it in national security too. You know, we know we've been attacked like XYZ in the past. How do we think it will happen in the future? And it happens in public health as well, that we do that kind of game playing out and thinking about. But I think that to be ready for the next outbreak, I think we all kind of at all different levels, we need to be thinking about how to let that past inform us and not constrain us. And then a final thing would be driving home and creating more connections with communities. I think we need better communication, better health communication, public health communication that transcends political lines, that gets past all the kind of messiness that we have gotten stuck in this last time. So those are my final thoughts.
Well, those are good final thoughts. We'll leave it there. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on the show again. Hopefully a year from now, we won't need to have you back on to talk about COVID-19, but no promises.
Have me back on to talk about, I don't know, something else. Maybe
Well, yeah, let's hope not another pandemic. Right?
Yeah, we'll talk about historical pandemics.
I think that would be fantastic, and we won't wait a year for that.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you, Coyle.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high